While we're waiting for more members to arrive, we'll take Senator Scoy's wild rice bill first. Senate File 3550. Senator Scoy.
Oh, because I'm here scrambling on an amendment for it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File. I don't even see the number of it here.
3550.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. 3550 is a result of work that the legislature did last year, asking a group of stakeholders to meet over the summer in the interim to look at threats with regard to wild rice that's growing in our natural lakes and rivers. And they did work. This is kind of the start of what we're going to be working on over the next year or so as this work group continues to explore the threats to wild rice. At this point, members, I do want to say that, you know, wild rice is our native state grain. It is one of the grains that natural to this area, and the germplasm for wild rice is in abundance here in Minnesota, and it behooves us to protect this valuable resource. So this group is doing good work. One of the recommendations from the working group was to try to bring all of the statutes dealing with wild rice together and put them into one place, and that's part of what this bill is. There was a little unintended consequence, I guess we would say, of doing that, in that it did bring the labeling law for wild rice into this bill, and that really isn't what the intent of the work group was to deal with, or any intent of the legislative initiative from last year to make changes to that labeling law. This is a law that the stakeholders, the cultivated growers and the hand-harvested organic lake rice industries had agreed to a number of years ago. And so I've been in discussion with the department on this, and we'd like to take that labeling provision out, and also the changes where we're making changes from natural to wild rice from lake and river. I think at this point in time, we should leave the words lake and river wild rice in place. And so I don't know if Mr. Knopf has had the opportunity to finish the amendment that we talked about earlier or not, or if this is something that we should be working on after we lay it on the table for possible inclusion, Mr. Chair. But I just want the committee to know that that was kind of an unintended consequence of bringing all of these statutes together. So
I
other
want any more.
Say that again, Mr. Knopf.
Mr. Knopf. Mr. Chairman, Senator Scoy, I was just answering a question from the committee staff on whether this would need to go to the Ag Committee. And if you remove Sections 2 and 3, it will not need to go to the Ag and Veterans Committee. The other thing we talked about is removing those two sections plus reinserting. Well, lake or river doesn't show up in Chapter 84, and they were putting the word natural in throughout. Do you want the term natural to be lake or river throughout where the department was inserting the word natural?
Mr. Chair and Mr. Knopf, yes, in discussions that I had with the department, we think that the lake or river rice is an accurate description, and is the appropriate words to use in those situations. And then in the ag provisions, we're using the word cultivated or paddy rice. So that's the lines that we're drawing there.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Scoy, I don't have a written out amendment. I've been going through. I mean, the word natural occurs many times. But I think what you could do, if you want to move an amendment to the bill, would be to delete sections 2 and 3. And replace the word natural wherever it occurs in the remainder of the bill with the term lake or river. Mm-hmm. And then I think, Mr. Chairman, you were also talking about eliminating the definitions on 4.10 to 4.15, unless you want to leave that in and just change the word natural lake or river.
Mr. Chair and members, I don't, after discussions with the department, if we make these other changes, we don't need to make the change in the definition of natural wild rice and cultivated wild rice, because we will have the definitions lake and river and cultivated. So I don't think we need the definition subdivision.
Mr. Chairman, your amendment would be delete sections 2 and 3 on page 1 and 2, pages 1 and 2, and then on page 4, delete lines 4.10 to 4.15. And then on the remainder of the bill, wherever the new term natural occurs, would be to replace it with the term lake or river. And I think that would be the extent of your amendment, and we can set it aside and get it included that way.
Thank you, Mr. Knopf.
Do we need a motion, or do we have the intent?
And we should probably amend it now. And
okay.
Or somebody can do the motion.
Okay, Senator Fredrickson will move that. Yes, we have a quorum. Do you need to repeat that, Mr. Knopf?
I could repeat it. Chairman, I would move to delete sections 1 and 2.
2 and 3.
Delete sections 2 and 3 on page 4, delete lines 10 through 15, and wherever the term natural occurs in the bill, to substitute lake or river.
All right. Does that fit?
Fits, Mr. Chair.
Does everyone understand the amendment? Okay. Senator Fredrickson, on Senator Frederick's motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Questions on the bill?
Can I ask one question?
Mr. Knopf.
Mr. Chairman, excuse me if you just indulge me. Mr. Meyer, do you know on page 5, lines 9 to 10, where you're making that change to all of 84.091 for the receipts that will go into the wild rice account? Is there some reason you want to include ginseng license sales in the wild rice account?
Mr. Chair, members of the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. I need to revisit that whole issue now with the changes that have occurred in the bill. And one of the things is changing the name of that, the wild rice licenses and wild rice management account now. So, Mr. Chair, I'd like to get back to you with more information on that and work with Senate Counsel to clarify those issues and changes if they are needed.
Okay.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Meyer, I just want to point out that right now, the way that's structured, where you're deleting the subdivision 3 in the paragraph and clause references, they refer to specific wild rice licenses. But if you look on page 4 of the bill, you'll see on 4.27, you've got a license for buying and selling wild ginseng. And the reason that we have the elaborate method of determining which license fees go in this is to not pick up wild ginseng licenses. And but by striking that, you would. And I wasn't sure what the thought behind that was.
Mr. Chair, members, I think that's just an unintended consequence, perhaps, in the drafting of this language.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if it is, you really don't need to do the stricken language on 5.9 to 5.10, so you could just reinstate that stricken language, and you won't be picking up the ginseng money.
Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, on page 5, lines 9 and 10, I move to reinstate the stricken language.
Everybody understand the motion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Aye. Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Is there any did you have any testimony?
Mr. Chair, no, I really don't, other than, as I said earlier, this really is kind of the first little baby step that we're taking toward some of the protection of wild rice. We are working with the department on this as a aquatic plant and what kind of protections we need. Mr. Meyer certainly can answer questions with regard to specifics. But as we go through, not this year, but next year's, I would expect that we'll be before this committee with more legislation, as a result of the study group that the legislature enacted last year.
Does anyone wish to testify against this bill? Did I see a hand in the back? Okay. If there's no further discussion on Senate File 3550, it is laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus policy bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Senator Scoy, why don't we take your next bill, too?
Oh, thank you.
Get you out of here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, Mr. Chair, Joel Fisher from the fund is here to help me as I move through Senate File 3061. This is a bill dealing with two issues, really. One is cost recovery from the petrol fund. It's a provision that's really a streamlining of what we're currently doing, and Mr. Fisher will walk you through that. In Section 1, I do have an oral amendment, Mr. Chair. On page 1, line 12, after Attorney General and between Attorney General and Board, I need to insert the words on behalf of the, so it reads, by the Attorney General on behalf of the Board. So we're not removing the Attorney General from this process.
Senator Frederickson, you want to move that?
Senator Scoy, so I understand you want to reinstate the stricken Attorney General?
Yes, reinstate the stricken language and add on behalf of the.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I would move on page 1, line 12, reinstate the stricken Attorney General and insert after Attorney General on behalf of the.
Want to understand the amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Senator Scoy.
Mr. Chair, Section 2 is some cleanup language that is being adopted, and we're just getting it in compliance with what's going on. Section 3 is a provision that we should be talking a little bit about. There currently is an issue with regard to diesel fuel storage tanks that people have in their basements or houses that they use for heating fuel. And in the past few years, some of these tanks have been connected to the furnaces with plastic pipe. Now, this plastic pipe is not lasting forever, and the diesel fuel is going to be wearing away at the glue. And there have been some leaks in people's basements. What has happened, and I do have a notice here from, I believe it is State Farm, yes, State Farm, that they are putting an exclusion on their policy that they would not provide any coverage for any loss arising out of da-di-da-di-da, this fuel oil that's in the tank. So what we're trying to get at here, members, is a mechanism for these homeowners to work with the Petrol Fund and the department to replace these plastic lines before they leak. And I think that Mr. Fisher is going to help me with this issue also. But if you would, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Fisher from the Petrol Fund.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. The basic provision, yes, is that homeowners, single-family residents, residential homeowners would receive up to $400 per residence to have a qualified, basically a plumber, but a qualified person to replace the PVC piping with metal piping. One thing I can say from the department's perspective is that we have had some concerns about the ability to determine the fiscal impact on the fund, but there are conversations going on at this point that may lead to some amendments to this that would change the dollar amounts. If you have any specific questions about Petrol Fund reimbursements, what I should say at this point, the Petrol Fund does reimburse up to $1 million at 90% for cleanup costs. So there is the potential there could be savings if this provision is implemented, but it's unclear whether or not there would be or to what extent those savings would be.
And I believe this bill does have to go to another policy committee as well. Senator Frederickson?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Fisher, this bill is specific to PVC fill piping. Are there any connections out there where the piping between the tank and the furnace is PVC?
Mr. Fisher?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, generally what my understanding on this PVC piping is, it's usually the connection, usually the piping coming in from the outside of the house into the basement is metal piping. It would be from basically the in the basement to the tank. That's where the PVC piping is in place. And that's what we're seeing in the cases where the glue does, or where the piping does fail, it's a failing in the basement itself.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Fisher, the way this is worded, it says PVC fill piping. I'm wondering if we're getting at what we want to get at, because to me, when you say fill, it would be between the outside of the house and into the tank. And I wonder if for the purpose of this bill, if we'd better off to just delete fill.
Mr. Fisher? Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bob Grogan. I'm with the Minnesota Petroleum Marketers Association. Our members are the ones who, with their bulk trucks, fill heating oil tanks. Senator Frederickson, the connection from the tank to the furnace is copper. And it's hardly ever replaced with PVC. I'm not aware of whatever it is, if it ever has been. The reason that the fill pipe comes into play is that homeowners will remodel, move their tank, or do something and take the steel pipe down to put up a PVC pipe. There's almost always an elbow or a joint in there, and the fuel oil coming in will dissolve that glue at the joint, and then we get it running in the basement. There's very few, if any, PVC piping as the pipe to the burner gun.
Senator
Scoy. Small quarter to a half inch copper tube.
Senator Scoy.
Well, Mr. Chair, if there is such a small number, I wonder if we shouldn't delete the word fill, and then it would cover all of them if there was the odd example of somebody installing PVC piping from the tank to the furnace. Seems like a reasonable thing that Senator Frederickson has brought forward.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I'd move on page 2, line 28, delete the word fill.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
No, I'm sorry. I'm
all
fine.
Right.
Thanks.
Does everybody understand the amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Further discussion? Anyone wish to testify against this bill? Not seeing anyone approaching. So, Senator Frederickson, would you like to move the bill?
Mr. Chairman,
what is the local government?
Finance.
Commerce.
Mr. Chairman, I move that Senate File 3061 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce.
Okay. Everybody understand the motion? Further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr.
Senator.
Chairman.
All right, Senator Marty. Members, this is the low emissions vehicles California standards bill that we heard several weeks ago. We had extensive testimony. I'm not going to take any more testimony on the bill. However, I believe Senator Marty has an amendment or one amendment. And if there is relevant testimony to that amendment, we will take that. But make sure that if you do want to speak, it's to the amendment. Senator Marty.
And Mr. Chairman, this is, as you recall, the California Clean Car Standards, where we have a choice between whether we adopt the EPA ones, which we're currently under, or the California ones. We had all the testimony on this. At that hearing, one or two people mentioned the concern that this might be expanded. I don't see that it could be expanded to cover things other than cars and light trucks, like could be covering boats or all-terrain vehicles or whatever. So I had an A2 amendment prepared that would just make it real clear that if California jumped to include other things that we didn't want included, that we would, by default, we'd go back to the national standards. I'd argue it's purely comfort language because California has no plans to do that. Motor vehicle is defined under federal law, not under California law, but if they were, so if somebody wanted to offer the A2 amendment, I'd appreciate it, just to clarify what I think is the reality.
Is it drawn to the A1?
Senator Sharon will move the A2. Do you need to provide further explanation?
No, Mr. Chairman, as it says, that if California regulations extends it to any of these other vehicles, this section is no longer effective, and Minnesota bumps back to the federal standards instead of the other ones.
All right. Do you have witnesses for the amendment?
I don't feel a need for it. It's not really a change in the bill. It's just to make it clear that that's what it's doing.
Okay. Does anyone need to, in the audience, need to testify to the amendment? So you may approach. Not seeing anyone approaching. Discussion on the A2. Senator Scogin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Marty, I just want to thank you for offering this. This was part of the concern, the anxiety that some of us out in recreational land had. And so I appreciate you bringing this forward and agreeing to add it to the bill.
Thank you.
Okay. Senator Dibble.
Is it time for a motion yet, Mr. Chair?
Senator Sharon moved the A2 amendment.
Oh, we haven't voted on the amendment. Oh, okay.
Yep. Further discussion on the amendment. Seeing none, and I'm not seeing anyone who wants to approach the table to testify. On the A2, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. We are back on to Senate File 481. Senator Marty.
And, Mr. Chairman, I would just make one more summary pitch about the fact that we are dealing. We passed some very tough standards last year, and we put very heavy requirements on the utilities, the co-ops, the munis. In effect, doing this will make sure that we're not putting more burden for the climate change, the greenhouse gas issue. We're not going to put more burden on other sectors, but we'd have the auto industry and our transportation sector do its part as well. And again, I know there were lots of concerns about E85 and so on. I think we've answered all of them. California is moving that way, like we want to copy their standards and some of these things. They've already moving the way we've been. We provide leadership on that. And again, this does save money for consumers because the cars are more energy efficient, gas efficient. But again, the main thing is this will make a significant impact on greenhouse gases, and I'd urge your support and happy to answer any questions.
Senator Stump.
thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. You know, I think this piece of legislation is going to make a statement, but I think the problem is that we've got a lot of unworked out issues, and I feel very uncomfortable in adopting another state's set of standards when we are unique and have our own uniqueness about Minnesota, such as the ethanol industry and such as the volume of roads that that make up our state, and the truck car mix, and the, you know, and I applaud Senator Marty for his efforts in cleaning up the emissions, but I really feel that at this time it's not good for the state and is sending actually the wrong message by adopting another state's laws that aren't even effective until the court decides whether they are going to allow them to go ahead. Many of these issues, in particular the issues of relating to the environment, need to be addressed on a much larger scale than individual states. And that is true with our waters. It's true with our air. Those kinds of issues need to be worked with in compacts with other states, maybe regional, but even better at a national level across the whole country, and even at an international level, because at the same time we try to clean our environment up, countries like China and India go unchecked and pollute way more than what we could ever clean up on our own. So, you know, I really feel that this is unwise for us to send this signal of passing it on.
Before the last meeting, it was adopted.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really have to echo what Senator Stump just said. His statement was very clear, and I think to the point of what an awful lot of folks in our state believe in. I think this is overreaching. I think the federal standards are addressing this issue right now. I think Minnesota, you know, being on the forefront and dealing with things like this is fine and dandy, but I think I have to agree we have to slow down a little bit. I mean, what's going to be next? You know, I know the amendment here deals with ATVs, and you know, I'm concerned about if we start here, when is it going to be small engines, outboards, lawnmowers, chainsaws, weed whips? What's going to be next? So I think it's a little overreaching, and I think we need to slow down. And when we're dealing with looking at ethanol, we're looking at cellulosic issues here in the state. I think we're moving along quite quickly with regards to saving our air. So I certainly am absolutely agree with Senator Stumpf, and I would like to see this put on the back burner until another day.
Senator Parisel.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if there's more witnesses, if you have more witnesses, but if not, I would like to see a roll call vote on this when we take it.
All right. Roll call has been requested. Further discussion. Senator Dibble, did you want to do the motion?
Sure, Mr. Chair. Are we at that moment?
It seems so.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, I would move Senate File 481 without recommendation be referred to, where's it going?
State and local government.
State and local government.
Okay. But you understand the motion? Further discussion. Roll call has been requested. The clerk will take the roll.
Senator Anderson?
Yes.
Senator Dibble?
Yes.
Senator Dill? Senator Fredrickson?
No.
Senator Ingebrigtsen?
No.
Senator Olson? Senator Parisel?
No.
Senator Saxhog?
No.
Senator Sheeran?
Yes.
Senator Sieben?
Yes.
Senator Scogin?
Yes.
Senator Stumpf?
No.
And Senator Vickerman?
Chair will vote yes. With a vote of 6-5, the motion prevails.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much. I did hear the concerns. I will continue trying to address them in the other committees as well. Thank you all very much.
Thank you, Senator Marty.
State and local government.
Why don't we take Senator Olson? Senate File 3237. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. I'm here on behalf of Senate File 3237, which is a bill.
Hold on just a moment. Wait for the door to close.
It's got to be music.
Sweet George Brown.
Not all of us get to have our bills greeted with fanfare, Senator.
Well, Mr. Chair, I was going to say that this bill has created a lot of noise in my district, so maybe that's just consistent. This is a bill that would require the DNR to engage in rulemaking with regard to structures on water, and specifically what we're talking about are things like docks, dock platforms are kind of the issue that led to my attention and involvement in this bill. But there are other structures as well that we typically put out on the water, such as boat lifts and that type of thing. I have, first of all, before we start, an A1 amendment that I would like to introduce, which would put the bill in the shape that I'd like to have it considered. And basically, what this bill does, or what the amendment would do, is because there's already off rulemaking that's going on with regard to shoreline standards that this committee and the legislature and governor authorized last session, and because this is an issue that is very tied to that process in terms of looking at how we handle and regulate shorelands and water quality and issues to do with lakes, it really makes sense that it be part of that process and be handled at the same time, because we would expect that that people with the same or similar interests would want to be attending. And from a cost-saving standpoint, it's my understanding that this issue, way back when the alternative shoreline standards were first being promulgated and considered, that this started out as something that was initially planned to be considered as a part of that. And it's something that I think the DNR will tell you is an issue that still needs to be addressed. It's an issue that Wisconsin has addressed and other states as well. And so so what the amendment does is, rather than having this go forward as a separate process, it would basically incorporate that into the present rulemaking process that's underway at this point. And it deletes the effective date that this would have to be completed by, because it would be contemplated that it would be a part of that process and would be consistent with the effective date that those rules, that rulemaking would be, the time frame for that rulemaking.
Okay. This is an author's amendment. Senator Anderson will move the A1. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Senator Olson.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. This issue first came to my attention toward the end of last session when I received a number of emails, and maybe some of you received them as well, that talked that were from people who were concerned about the DNR enforcing the law with regard to large dock platforms that were in place on the end of docks. And essentially, my understanding of the history of this, and this is, again, I'm not an authority in this area, but in looking into this in response to these emails I was receiving, prior to 2002, there was a rule in place that said that docks were allowed. And the first thing I guess I was reminded of by the DNR is the concept that the waters in front of land are public waters. They belong to the public. They do not belong to the lakeshore owner. And even as one of those lakeshore owners myself, so I can certainly understand the point of view of the lakeshore owner, there are limited rights that the law has granted to lakeshore owners to have, to be able to do certain things with respect to the public waters. And with respect to docks, the lakeshore owners had the right to put what was called put a narrow structure out into the water, and the purpose of that structure was to be able to put a boat, to get in and out of a boat and to dock a boat. And that was historically the reason why you were granted the right to have a dock in front of in front of your lot. Their interpretation, the DNR's interpretation of a narrow structure prior to 2002 was about a 4 to 5 foot structure, and that was the explanation I've been given from the DNR. I don't believe that that was codified anywhere or even set in rule anywhere, but that was their interpretation of narrow. Basically, they were allowing the typical dock that we all know and have seen over the years, the 4 to 5 foot structure. In 2002, however, from the DNR's point of view, expanded what was allowed to allow an 8-foot structure to go into place. So now docks were no longer limited to 4 or 5 feet. They were now allowed to be up to 8 feet wide. And then since 2002, again, historically, my understanding is there wasn't a lot of enforcement of that regulation until just the last few years. and that in the last few years, especially in certain isolated lakes around the Gull Lake Whitefish chain area and also around Lake Minnetonka, there has become an increased use of these very large platforms that are sometimes referred to as patio or party platforms. But basically, changing the use of these platforms, increasing their size, and making them a place to kind of substitute for many docks that didn't have good access to the water, kind of a substitution for a beach being built out on the water. And many of the emails that I received talk about wanting to be able to entertain on these platforms, wanting to be able to have their entire families out there. I had some people send me emails saying there should be no restriction on the size or that they should be allowed up to 1,500 square feet or, you know, all kinds of things like this. But basically, the point was that they felt in many of these emails that as lakeshore owners and paying considerable taxes as lakeshore owners, that they had rights out on that public water that allowed them to use it in ways that would be desirable for them. And especially if they had restrictions on their land, if they had a high bank or if they had a wetland in front of their land, they wanted to be able to have the platform out on the water to kind of substitute for the lack of beach access to the water. So as I looked into this issue and received these emails, actually there was an amendment introduced at the end of last session, I think on the House side, that ended up coming out of conference committee, that required the DNR, rather than going through rulemaking on this, to have four public hearings to take public input over this issue. And in the meantime, the DNR issued a general permit. Rather than enforcing that 8-foot law, they issued a general permit that said they would not enforce the law for a period of a year while they had these public meetings and took that kind of input. So they did have those meetings. They put online the input they received from those meetings. I was disappointed with the meetings because none of them happened up within my district, although one did happen in Nisswa, which was close to my district, and I didn't feel the general public was made very aware of these meetings, so that mostly it was people who were, I felt the people who knew about it primarily were people who had a vested interest in this, the people who were manufacturing docks, the people who had these platforms, or the people who were, about half of the emails I received were from realtors. But nevertheless, at these meetings, when I went online and looked at the messages, and it seemed as though a significant majority of them were against expanding the rules to allow for something larger than these 8-foot docks. They also allowed public input to be online, that they would take public input. And one of my witnesses here has said that he's actually gone and taken those comments off of the internet and stacked them up side by side, and in his opinion, they were about 2-1 against the expansion for these dock platforms. In addition, I had public meetings on a proposal, an independent proposal, a separate proposal I have for Star Lakes, which I presented to this committee earlier. At those public meetings, one in the Bemidji area and one in Hackensack, even though I was not there to talk about dock platforms, the people who attended these meetings were very concerned about the DNR's process of or what they felt was going to be an expansion of the existing 8-foot rule. And so I had to have a stay after my Star Lake meetings to discuss this, and the very large majority of people there were very concerned about the expansion of these 8-foot of the 8-foot rule to allow for these dock platforms. So much has been said about this, and very passionately on the part of people who are wanting these platforms, and much has been said very passionately about the people who are concerned that we preserve the kind of the quality and the appearance of our lakes and the public's rights to public waters. But I'd just like to go through quickly some of the statements that have been made that would be advocating for these platforms, and just kind of bring them to your attention. One is that most of the docks are out of compliance, and so almost everyone would have to change their dock if we were to start enforcing this smaller existing 8-foot rule. In fact, the DNR has told me that they've done flyovers over the lakes where this is most heavily used. In fact, in most lakes, it's not happening at all. But where this is proliferating, where these large platforms are proliferating, the DNR has told me that about 10% of the docks are out of compliance. So it isn't the vast majority. It's a small percentage on the lakes where this is the biggest problem. Another thing that I've been told is that this is good for fish. And, you know, I wondered about that myself, because we all know that when we look under a dock, we tend to see fish under the dock. And so it seems like it must be a good thing for the lake. I will have, I met with biologists about this issue within the DNR and privately, and I think I'll let Mr. Sims address this issue, because he can do it much more scientifically than I can. But the short answer is that structures over the water are not good for the health of the lake. They cause erosion, they cause shading, they interfere with the places where fish spawn. And so, you know, there are a number of reasons why that we don't want to encourage this to go, not saying that we need to go backwards in terms of what we've allowed for docks, but why we don't want to encourage this to become a bigger problem for our lakes. I've also heard that many people have said, because they pay a lot of taxes to live on the water, that they really have a right to enjoy the water however they choose. And I guess I would really ask this committee not to accept that precedent, because our waters are public waters, and we have setbacks on land for where you can build your house. We have minimum lot sizes. We have a lot of rules and regulations right now to protect the health of our lakes, and those regulations apply to land that people do own. And we have accepted that when you live close to, in conjunction with water, and the things that you do are going to have an impact on that water, that you don't have a right to do whatever you want to in conjunction with that, with the land you own. Now we're talking about something you don't own. We're talking about public water. And so I would hope that we would say clearly that that your rights, simply because you may pay higher taxes or something like that, do not give you more rights than traditionally what's been recognized under riparian law in terms of your ability to utilize access to the water. And then one of the things that has been talked about most frequently or most recently by a website that's been created for people who have these or are promoting their use is the fact that we should be grandfathering in people who had existing structures such as this.
To some extent.
What I would submit is that what I did not end up saying before is that after those 4-year studies, what the DNR has ended up doing now is they've ended up issuing another 5-year permit that's going to allow these platforms, these 170 feet at the end of a dock, platforms to, they've issued another general permit for another 5 years. And I believe that's contrary to the public input, the majority of it. It's also contrary to a specific group that they formed after this public input. They set up
a docks advisory committee,
and that docks advisory committee had representation from the dock owners and from the dock manufacturers, but it also had representation from people who have scientific backgrounds or lake association backgrounds. And the recommendation of that advisory committee was also not followed by the DNR in issuing this additional five-year general permit. And the explanation for that, because I've seen some of the correspondence back and forth, was basically that they felt a need to compromise because of the political pressures that were coming into play by people who really wanted these things. So the process was not followed. Even their own committee recommendations were not followed. And as a result, we have a general permit for something that potentially would allow a large platform in front of every lake lot on every lake in our state, which, if you think about it, that's a real big change in terms of the appearance of our lakes today and what we are potentially saying under law would be allowed. Also, I've been told by the DNR, well, we can try this for 5 years, and if it becomes a problem, we can go backwards. Well, we all know that when it comes to people doing things on lakes, that there's an expectation that anything you allow is going to be grandfathered in. And once you say it's all right, something that's a small problem today on a few lakes in our state is going to become a problem everywhere we go, and we might as well just say that that's going to be the standard from now on. Now, one of the things that I thought did make sense to me in some of the letters that I received from people who wanted these platforms was they said, you know, why are you picking on my platform when my neighbor has 10 docks and 4 boat lifts and this and that? And right now in the state, unlike Wisconsin and a number of other states, we have no restrictions on the amount of surface water you can cover with whatever you choose to cover in front of your lakeshore. And as we see more pressure being put on our lakes and more people retiring and more of our lakeshore being developed, I guess I would just urge you that now is the time to get involved in just asking the questions, going through the process of saying what is appropriate and what's reasonable and what isn't, and that this is part of that equation, because it really doesn't make sense to just look at platforms and not look at the broader issue. We're doing that already right now with shoreline standards, and so making this a part of that analysis and a part of that process seems to be the most cost-effective way and the most reasonable way to approach this. When we look at the value of our lakes, aesthetically, in terms of our resorts and people coming to northern Minnesota or to Minnesota as a whole and enjoying our lakeshore, when we look at the health of our lakes and water and what we're spending now and going to be spending to keep our lakes healthy and clean, and when we look at traditional riparian law in terms of what the rights to the of the lakeshore owner onto the enjoyment and use of public waters, how that's been balanced with the ownership of public waters, this seems to me to be the time and to make sense to engage in this process. Thank you very much, committee members. And at this point, if I could, I'd like to give Mr. Dan Sims an opportunity to testify. He's Mr. Sims is an aquatic biologist. He works for the Beltrami Soil and Water, and he also was a part of the task force that the DNR set up to look at this issue.
Senator Olson, members, before we go to the testimony, why don't we get an idea from council what the current rule is, what it was, what changed in recent months to stir up this issue? Mr. Knopf?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have the rule in front of me. I don't have copies of what it was before. But my understanding of the situation is that DNR had a little more of a vague, as part of their rules as to what constitutes a dock that didn't require a permit. And then what happened is they basically defined that better to reflect what their thinking was on what a dock would, the size of a dock before you would need a special permit to install the dock. And then what happened was is they started enforcing that new standard on people, and a lot of people had docks that were pre-existing that had been installed in previous years that were in violation of that new standard. They did assert that technically these docks may have been in violation of the previous standard, but they never enforced it. So there really wasn't a knowledge out there that these docks were in violation. So the standard was updated, and to some people maybe changed, but I think DNR staff would argue that it really didn't change. They were just being very much more specific and being enforced. And I think so that's what kind of started all of this. And as I understand it, then the general permit that was issued was to cover a lot of these docks that now would be in violation of the new standards, but it were probably in violation of the old standard, but again, it wasn't as clear and it was not being enforced prior to the new standards. That's my understanding of how the situation evolved.
Mr. Axon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Whoever can answer this, Senator Olson. So, as counsel said, he wasn't particularly specific, but when the DNR did get specific, did they say an 8-foot dock and how long and what can they have on the end or?
Mr. Chair, Senator Saxhawk, I believe that in 2002, when they enacted a more specific standard, the rule was that it couldn't be more than 8 foot wide in one direction. So that, you know, you can go out and you can turn the corner, but at no point can the width of it become more than 8 feet. And I think that the rule, someone I'm sure will correct me if I'm wrong, is that you can go out to the depth that's necessary to get a boat in the water. I think it's like 4 feet of depth. So there's no specific standard that says that it has to be a certain length, because every lake is different in terms of its depth. But the idea was, you know, to get out there as far as it was going to be needed to get into deep enough water. And there was no accommodation for a platform except up to 8 feet wide. So most docks aren't going to be 8 feet wide all the way out, but you could have an area where it would become as much as 8 feet wide. Or if you wanted to, under the old rule, you could have it 8 feet wide all the way out if you wanted to.
We're passing out a information sheet that explains that, and while we're hearing testimony, members can read it and gain a better understanding. Senator Saxhawk?
I just have one follow-up on that, Mr. Chair. Senator Olson, is the 8 foot dock, I mean, I see an old one right here with the metal posting. What is the standard width of a dock? Do you remember? I mean, I'm trying to visualize what that is.
Senator Olson?
Mr. Chair, Senator Saxhawk, I think a standard dock is 4 feet wide, you know, plus the metal, you know, that would come on both sides of it. And some might be 5 feet wide, but
to give you a general understanding, this table is 9 feet wide. So 8 feet would be just slightly less than the width of this table. Mm-hmm. Senator Fredrickson?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, if you allow me to ask a little broader question, a little different question, and rely on your other field of expertise. If somebody put a dock out, say, out into 8 foot of water, and they had a 12-foot or 16-foot end to it, and some children were tubing behind a boat, and they accidentally hit this dock that was out of compliance with the rules, and it was out of conformity with the rest of the docks, would that dock owner have an increased liability?
Mr. Chair and Senator Fredrickson, this is going to be totally off the cuff.
I realize that.
And so please, I hope no one listening to this takes this as a legal opinion of any kind, because without doing any research on this area, I really couldn't offer a legal opinion. But my initial reaction to that would be that it would depend on whether the size of the dock contributed to the accident. So I suppose you could, I mean, because usually under tort law, there's got to be causation. And so if you had a dock that, if the injury would have happened if it had been in compliance, then I would say that the non-compliance probably didn't cause the injury. But if you had an injury, if the size of the dock was what would cause the injury, then I suppose you would have that argument.
Mr. Chairman, I did note the disclaimer that Senator Olson gave.
Okay, let's move to the witnesses.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Dan Sims, Beltrami Soil and Water Conservation District. I just want to make six really brief points here about why I think this rulemaking process is really important. First of all, the general permit that was issued based on very short-term political expediency, which is understandable because this is going to be a contentious issue no matter what, because people have different opinions. But ultimately, I think most Minnesotans are concerned with the integrity ecologically of their lakes and want to see the right thing done, and there's considerable science out there that should be incorporated into this decision-making process, and the general permit failed to do that. Also, the current rules as they stand the current rules as they stand are fairly ambiguous in certain points, and this causes a problem not only for property owners in interpreting what they can and can't do, but for dock manufacturers and dock owners the same way. Even the way that width is defined is a bit ambiguous in the current rules and probably needs a little bit more clarity. But in addition, what's happened since the over the last, say, two or three decades is that we've seen a proliferation of accessory structures to go along with docks. Wisconsin, for example, has addressed that by limiting the number of accessory structures associated with any given parcel, limiting the number of docks to a single dock. We haven't done any of that. And as demographic changes increase the pressure for development and redevelopment, the character of our lakes could change fairly dramatically. A third point that I think is particularly troublesome is that this general permit process that was used is really unprecedented in terms of general permits. General permits are usually issued to streamline processes where individual permits would be routinely granted. So if there are certain procedures that counties need to do for ditch maintenance or something like that, rather than have every time you want to maintain a ditch, you come in for a permit, a general permit would be offered for, again, for individual permits routinely granted. In this case, individual permits were not being granted and would be very unlikely to be granted under the current rules. The current rules would only allow a platform in cases where that platform was shown to be a minimum impact solution to a demonstrated need. And since need for these platforms was never established, in individual cases, authorizing a general permit to allow such platforms statewide seems odd at best, and really, again, unprecedented in the way permits are used. And perhaps if Mr. Lacosmo is here, he might be able to address that a bit as well. A couple things also that I want to emphasize. There are subjective sorts of things here about what is considered aesthetically desirable in Lakeshore. And I think in many ways, those probably play out real differently from one part of the state than another. And in many ways, I think that is probably the least important reason for regulating docks and accessory structures, because everybody has different opinions about that. But there are two other issues, one being related to public accessibility and the other being related to ecological integrity. And one of the problems with this current approach is that it is a one-size-fits-all approach that assumes that if a platform is a good thing on the Whitefish chain, it's a good thing in Beltrami County as well. And in Beltrami County, where our quality of life and our tourist industry depend on that natural aesthetic, that gets to be more of an issue. And sort of having this blanket one-size-fits-all general permit authorizing these platforms statewide is problematic. Finally, from an ecological standpoint, which is where my interest comes into this, there is a perception that's out there that there is no science demonstrating the negative impacts of docks, platforms, and accessory structures, and that's just inaccurate. On the handout that I brought here, there are three papers cited about vegetation, about fish populations, and about shifts in productivity from rooted vegetation to algae. And this is not controversial. The data that are available, the studies that are available, are consistent in showing that docks and accessory structures have some adverse impacts. And I just want to summarize those really quickly, what they are. Mary mentioned the case of fish gathering under the dock. The reason that fish gather under the dock, and particularly the reason that fish that are actively feeding, which is why you got bass fishermen, for example, fishing on the end of your dock, are gathered there, is because the loss of vegetation associated with docks and accessory structures provides predation corridors. And what happens, and this is, again, very well documented in the literature, predatory fish come in and prey on young-of-the-year fish from all different kinds of species that, after they hatch, go out into open water. During the middle of the first summer, they come back into shallow water and are in those areas right around the docks. With intact vegetation, there's very little perimeter for that total area of plant material, lots of places, in other words, for those young-of-the-year fish to hide. With a lot of docks and accessory structures, the amount of perimeter per surface area increases really dramatically, and predation pressure increases really dramatically. This isn't conjecture. This is very well documented, and some of the studies that I cite here point that out. A second concern for those of us that are interested in maintaining water clarity and water quality in lakes is that when we remove vegetation, the phosphorus that would be taken up by that rooted vegetation is still in the system and it's made available for algae. And what happens, and it's again well demonstrated, is that when we limit the amount of aquatic plants, rooted aquatic plants, we decrease water clarity by increasing the amount of algae in the system. And when that happens, we start a whole cascade of kind of adverse changes. And then third, and one of the issues that's been kind of at the heart of some of the controversy around this matter has been around invasive species. And one of the things that we know about invasive species is that what makes them invasive is they're good colonizers. But they're not good at going into a place where there's not a disturbance. They're good colonizers moving into a place where there's been a disturbance. And docks and accessory structures open bottom sediments to invasive plant species. Again, a very well-documented phenomenon. So what needs to be done, I would argue, would be that we need to do a rulemaking process to avoid some of the confusion, to make it clear for homeowners, for dock manufacturers, exactly what the regulations are, what the rationale is for those regulations, with the ultimate goal that I think all of us share, whether we're on, you know, one side or another on this particular platform issue, I think all of us are really committed to the idea that we want to maintain the long-term ecological integrity of our lakes. The way to get that done is not by dubious general permits, but by legitimate, scientifically based rulemaking processes, and that is what the legislation that Mary is authoring calls for. Thank you.
Question for the witness, Senator Scogin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sims, accessory structures, are they permitted?
No.
Like docks? I mean, you mentioned them several times. You would say docks and accessory structures.
Right. Right now, most docks aren't permitted either. There's no permit required for a dock, no permit required for most docks because they're small enough to not require a permit. There's no permits required for boat lifts, things along that line. In Wisconsin, in some other states where they've started to look at kind of cumulative impacts more seriously, they look, for example, at the dimensions of a parcel and then limit the amount of overwater coverage in proportion to the dimension of the parcel so that you have rules in place that avoid sort of a continuous boardwalk of docks, platforms, boat lifts ringing a lake. And the thing about it is this general permit only applied to general development and recreational development lakes in Minnesota, but a lot of those lakes were typically platted with 50 and 75-foot lots. So if you put a 10-by-17 platform out on the end of a dock and put a couple of boat lifts and a pontoon lift on one side of that, pretty soon, you know, you're covering your 50 feet completely. And that's, again, one of the issues, is to try to have rules that build some flexibility in so that we don't have this kind of one-size-fits-all. We're going to have large platforms all around Minnesota because it was the sort of politically expedient, easy way out.
Senator Saxog.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are we talking about a different set of rules for commercial docks, resorts, or is that going to be the same?
There's a whole set of provisions in the dock rules for commercial docks. It's a completely different issue.
And what this bill is doing is not setting out what we should be doing. Mm-hmm. It's saying that establishing a process for doing something, whatever that end might be, and that will include extensive public comment. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And another point I would make is that, I mean, as we see increased development pressure on our lakes, I don't think there's a question or that even the DNR would argue that this is something we need to do. The question is, should we do it? Are we going to open the door for 5 years and then try to go backwards from there, or is it easier and more expedient and more fair to lakeshore owners to get a handle on it now before we have a bigger problem than we already have? And also, then once we've gone through this process for dock manufacturers and for everyone, we have a permanent solution rather than a 5-year solution with everyone wondering what's going to happen after that point.
All right, your next witness.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Marilee Myers. I am president of the Beltrami County Lakes and Rivers Association. And in front of you, you very probably have a resolution that we wrote and passed and are planning to present to our county commissioners. I also was a member of the DNR convened Docs Advisory Committee. We were doing nothing in Beltrami County until the new general permit came out in January, when I went through it and realized that 99% of the DAC's recommendations had been completely ignored, including the length of time that we would agree to a general permit, because we were required to agree to a general permit. It changed from expiring in 2010 to lasting for 5 years. No one was in favor of that. There was a consensus with the whole committee that rulemaking was essential to going forward with protecting our lakes. People need to know and want to know what they can do with their docks. And this includes, again, as Mr. Sims pointed out, dock manufacturers. They were very willing to go along with rulemaking because they are, in fact, selling products to the public, and they do not want to face any sort of litigation when it turns out that what they are providing and installing is not legal anymore. Interestingly, in the published general permit, it encouraged or permitted each county to individually opt out of the general permit, going back to the 2002 rules that are in place. In one of the drafts of this general permit, the counties were allowed to opt in to the general permit. By changing the wording to opt out, the DNR is requiring the county to do the DNR work. We have written the resolution. We will be presenting it to our county commissioners. The final point of the resolution is that we would very much encourage them to encourage the DNR to start the rulemaking process. Currently, the counties are being asked, being encouraged, being put in the position of making recommendations or rules that the DNR should be doing, and understandably, our county commissioners are extremely reluctant to get involved in DNR business. We will be going back to the county commissioners in April at one of their regular meetings to discuss our resolution. I have no sense as to whether they will be even amenable to considering it at great length. During one of their work sessions, they decided to simply not address it. If we bring it in front of them, they will hopefully be of a mind that they will take some sort of action on it. So we have some idea what our county commissioners are thinking about the importance of protecting our environment. Thank you.
Sarah Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have talked to at least two of the local county commissioners who basically have decided, at least up to this point, that they're not going to take any action, and they've told me that they would prefer to see this handled at the state level and by the DNR, and they don't really want it shifted to the county.
Questions for the witness? Thank you.
Here.
Do you have any other witnesses, Senator?
If you have time, yes, Mr. Chair. Dr. Johnson.
Okay. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
I'm Bob Johnson. I'm a cabin owner on Little Sand Lake in Hubbard County. And as I was asked by our Little Sand Lake Air Association to come and testify, while I am not an advocate of a lot of rules, on the other hand, I know the lack of them can produce all kinds of strange behavior. The first suggestion I would make would be that the DNR meet with every lake area association and tell them exactly what the rules are, because at this point, none of us knows. I can prove that simply by walking up and down the shoreline and showing you that. Secondly, We have a swim raft that sits out in front of us in the summertime, about 450 feet out in the lake. It is painted blue with reflectors on it. And when I asked the man who put it out there why he put it out there, he said, that's where the lake starts to get below 4 feet deep. And I said, isn't that a little dangerous? He said, well, it's got reflectors. And I said, how many boats do you know have headlights? He didn't have an answer. Then he got into a quarrel with his neighbor. And they didn't believe that their lot lines didn't extend out into the lake. So what they did was they had a quarrel and they built two docks. When they ended up out in the lake, they were about a half a foot off of each other. And so you could walk back and forth between the two docks. Now, to my knowledge, nobody from the DNR, nobody from anywhere came and said, you can't do that. I would just assume they come and tell us, you can't do that. So I argue at one instance, make the restrictions those that perhaps first are identified by the DNR to the Lake Area Associations. Secondly, that the Lake Area Associations, as per each lake, give their recommendations to the DNR regarding that particular lake. And thirdly, that when they have those recommendations, they bring them to you for enactment in terms of legislation. My feeling is we have a DNR office on our lake. I have never, ever seen the man. And he lives about a half a mile from me. I don't know what he does. I really don't. So my concern basically is to say, lean heavily on the Lake Area Associations to tell you what is going on and what they want. Now, that doesn't mean we should get everything we want. It simply means we need guidelines. We need some kind of statement that says, I will abide by thus and such and so. On land, Hubbard County has a rule that if your cabin is closer than 100 feet to the lake shore, you can't have a deck that extends more than 8.25 feet out in front of your house. Now, I don't know where the 8.25 feet came from, but nevertheless. Now, a deck is defined as anything that is 3 feet or higher above the ground. But if you have it less than 3 feet, you can build a platform. There is no restriction. Now, it feels to me like that's kind of what you're playing with. My wife's solution to our deck problem was fill in the soil and bring our deck, but so it is now not a deck anymore, but a platform by definition. So my concern at this point, you know, as I read through these recommendations, I can speak Greek, Hebrew, German, French, and a little Russian. You could read them, write them in this, and I could understand them better in probably Greek or Hebrew. Not this. So I want you, I guess my hope, my prayer is that, and I've been a Lutheran pastor for 45 years, is that somehow, some way, you will come, go back, first of all, to the Lake Area Associations and say to them, you need to be educated by the DNR. What are the restrictions? And what do you recommend to us that we should have as restrictions? If we're going to live as neighbors, it seems to me we have to have some kind of boundaries. That's your job, it seems to me. Provide the boundaries. I'm perfectly willing to live by them. Some of them sound a little like the Hubbard County statement on decks and platforms, sound a little ridiculous, but I live by them. So my concern basically is to say, first and foremost, ecologically, the lake needs to be maintained no matter what. Secondly, that we all understand our neighbors' needs, but we also are willing to restrict our needs to a certain level that is responsible to neighbors on either side. And thirdly, that we would do nothing that would pollute the lake. And it seems to me that what you're hearing is essentially, with no restrictions, it seems to me we'll have the people who just might build two docks that meet 50 feet out in the lake. I would say that doesn't solve anything. In fact, it creates wars. And so that's my thought.
Thank you. Questions for the witness? Senator Dill.
Mr. Chairman, and to the witness, is that swimming raft or dock or platform still out in the lake 450 feet?
Well, every summer it's there, and people come and ask us why we put our swim raft out there, and we said it's not ours, it's our neighbor's two places down. And I really have fear that at some night some skidoo or boat with no headlights will come and smash into that thing, because you cannot see it until you're right on top of it, maybe 5-6 feet. Now, I know it's there, and when I've come back from fishing and haven't gotten back before the sun goes down, it's hard to see. Now, I've had a lot of people offer to blow it up for me, but I haven't resorted to that yet.
Senator Olson, then we need to move to the next witness.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate that. You said I could have two witnesses, and I've had three. I would just call the committee's attention to a letter from the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, again, supporting the need for rules and in opposed to the path that the DNR has gone. I also included some letters and emails. I received just samples of them, both pro and con, to just kind of give you a feel for what some of the comments have been on both sides. Thank you.
Thank you. Sam Stern. Welcome to the committee.
Thank
please,
you, sir.
Please introduce yourself.
Will do. Senator, nice to meet you. You corresponded. I'm mindful of Senator Hillary Clinton complaining about always having to go first. From my point of view, I think I'd have rather gone first today. That was an excellent presentation, Senator. Mr. Chairman, members of the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee, thank you for giving me this opportunity to testify today regarding Senate File 3237, which calls for rulemaking by the DNR to regulate structures in the public waters. My name is Sam Stern. I'm an attorney representing an association of property owners protecting useful lake access rights. We both got fanfare, or popular for short. A little more than 2 months ago, I was asked by a client who owns lakeshore property to investigate pending DNR rules impacting docks and platforms. Recommendations of the DNR's Dock Advisory Committee were anticipated by mid-January, and my client and a few of his fellow lakeshore owners, who had all learned of the work of the Dock Advisory Committee after its public comment period had expired, were concerned about the impact of rulemaking on their use and enjoyment of the public waters. Each of this handful of individuals had invested in dock structures long before the current regulations were implemented for the 2003 season, and each property owner's structure exceeded the 8-foot-wide limitation of the subsequently adopted regulations. Having been clueless in the 2002 rulemaking process and behind the curve with respect to the DNR's public discussions in 2007, my client and his colleagues directed me to protect their interests. Determined not to be overlooked again, like-minded lakeshore property owners, who not incidentally take their responsibilities as stewards of the public waters very seriously, have formed Popular and are committed to assuring that any additional regulation of their use and enjoyment of the public waters is actually needed, avoids a one-size-fits-all implementation across a plethora of geographic and environmental lakeshore configurations, recognizes the historical use of lakeshore property that often spans multiple generations without degrading the public's enjoyment of the lake, recognizes the importance of the marine and dock industries in Minnesota and the threats posed by unnecessarily restrictive regulation, acknowledges the economic impact enjoyed and relied upon by lakeshore jurisdictions as a result of the decision to allow development of lakeshore property in exchange for premium rates of taxation, and I stress premium rates of taxation, weighs the benefits afforded by shoreline, afforded the shoreline by the utilization of docks, platforms, and boat lifts, is based on sound scientific principles that do not measure aquatic impact against the assumption that the shoreline is otherwise undeveloped, and can be universally enforced, consistent with constitutional assurances of equal protection and due process. Membership in Popular is easy. You send an email to protectlakes@gmail.com and ask to be put on the mailing list. Since early January, more than 250 Minnesotans have requested to be put on that mailing list, and many of the email recipients forward the communications from Popular to members of lake associations, giving them Popular an even wider audience. For example, since February 7th, Popular members have been able to keep track of efforts on Popular's blog, found at protectlakes.blogspot.com. And I checked last night, as of last night, so a little over a month, the blog had received 2,125 visits from 950 unique visitors. You know, I apologize for this long-winded background, but I think it's important for the committee to understand that this is an issue that cuts across socioeconomic and partisan lines and is not asserted by a few wealthy despoilers of the environment. Proponents of increased DNR regulations suggesting otherwise are engaging in rhetorical sleight of hand designed to mask the generally unaccepted consequences of their agenda from our point of view. Popular is not merely concerned with the size of allowed dock platforms. The association has grave reservations about the outcome of further rulemaking. The aquatic impact area, incorporated into the DNR's 2008 general permit, albeit on a discretionary basis, signals the direction that unimpeded new regulations would lead. A lakeshore property owner's entire impact on the public waters is limited under this aquatic impact area to the lesser of 50 feet or one-half the length of their shoreline. In other words, someone with 200 feet of shoreline is allowed the same 50-foot impact as someone with 100 feet of shoreline. The owner of a typical 60-foot shoreline lot would be allowed to impact 30 feet. Given the 8-foot wide dock allowed under current regulations and assuming the ownership of a 10-foot wide pontoon boat, the owner of a typical 60-foot shoreline lot would be hard-pressed to safely utilize the balance of his or her impact area for a swimming beach and might or might not be able to use existing accessory structures like a boat lift. If the committee believes that more than 2,000 visits to the new blog in a month is impressive, imagine the response that will be generated when a couple hundred thousand lakeshore owners are told to reduce the length of their docks, the number of their docks, the number of their watercraft, and the use of accessories like boat lifts or canopies. Consider the economic impact on a vital marine industry faced with regulatory impediments to the sale of additional watercraft. Popular believes that Senate File 3237 should be amended in two ways, and I'll address the amendment that was passed as well, not understanding that that was forthcoming. We believe that the First Amendment should give the DNR at least 3 years to undertake meaningful scientific and economic studies to determine the impact of additional regulation on public waters and the public, a group which, by the way, includes lakeshore property owners. Forcing rulemaking within a year on an agency that has already determined that it did not have the finances or personnel to follow the recommendations of the Dock Advisory Committee and engage in rulemaking this year will only lead to a hurried and publicly unacceptable outcome. With respect to the amendment adopted today, I'm not familiar with the status of the shoreline management regulations, but the concern would be the same. Popular is not against further study and rulemaking in and of itself, but it wants to make sure that there's enough time to get adequate input. I share Senator Olson's concern over the lack of public input at the DOC advisory, at the town meetings that the DNR held. Our belief is that part of the problem was that they were scheduled during midweek, that property owners that lived in the Twin Cities didn't have the ability to get up north to attend and make themselves heard. And the one hearing that was held in the Twin Cities in Wayzata was held on the Thursday evening before the Labor Day weekend, when a lot of folks had already taken off. And so if we're going to have public hearings, then I think it's important that there be enough time and they be widely enough publicized so that the full scope of the impacts here can be assessed. The second, and with respect to the shoreline management rulemaking, clearly, as has been stated, the dock and dock platform issue and other issues really haven't been addressed, and we don't want to have them prematurely resolved. The second issue that we believe that the legislature should consider with respect to 3237 is to mandate that any new rulemaking by the DNR that limits the use and enjoyment of lakeshore property should provide for several things. It should provide for what I'm referring to as legacy docks, docks that were initially installed prior to the 2003 season up to the size that the dock was last installed prior to 2008. We're not looking for the right to expand for those folks, but if they established the dock prior even to the 2003 regulations that first went into effect in 2003, and there hasn't been any enforcement against those or problems with them, they ought to be allowed to maintain those. We also believe that any rulemaking should allow dock platforms of up to 200 square feet exclusive of the last dock extension, thereby enabling lakeshore property owners to utilize either standard 4-foot or standard 5-foot wide sections, in other words, 5 4-by-10s or 4 5-by-10s. This isn't much larger than the 170 square feet total that's allowed under the current 2008 permit. The dock platform under the 2008 permit in and of itself is not allowed to exceed 120 square feet. It's with an additional up to 5-by-10 section added to that that you get to the 170. So when we talk about 170 square feet at the end of a dock, in fact, that incorporates the dock itself. We believe that the legislation should mandate that there be the issuance of permits to persons who installed non-compliant docks between 2003 to 2008 up to the size of the dock last installed prior to 2008, where specific needs, criteria relating to safety, lake access, or shoreline configuration are met. Senator Olson's materials point out that there is a permitting process that's been in place since 2002. I've had several meetings with the DNR, who've been very cooperative, frankly, and they turned over information on the number of permits that were issued, and basically there weren't any permits issued. And anecdotally, my popular members tell me that when they inquired of the DNR, they were told not to bother, you're not going to get one, but we're not going to enforce anything against you anyway. So if we're going to go forward, then there needs to be a recognition that there are people that have legitimate needs for larger platforms, primarily involving safety issues and access to the lake issues, where the configuration of the lake doesn't allow for a beach or otherwise enjoyment. Here's my third rail. We're looking for abatement of property taxes to the extent limitations on the amount of usable shoreline are imposed, determined by applying the same formula to the amount of abandoned shoreline previously used by the relevant tax assessor to impose an enhanced valuation for tax purposes on the same linear footage. My friend the doctor wouldn't have understood that. As I read it, I need to make it clear. There is a premium assessed based on the amount of shoreline that a person owns. And what we're saying is if we end up adopting rules that limit the amount of shoreline that one is allowed to utilize, if this aquatic impact area
is adopted, then it's only fair that since the view of the lake is free for everybody, if people are being deprived access of a certain portion of their lakeshore, they shouldn't be taxed at a premium rate on having the additional shoreline lineage. And it's just fundamentally unfair to ask them to pay at a premium rate for property that new regulations determine they have no greater use of than the general public or than their neighbor across the lot line. We'd also look for compensation for rendering what are currently legal dock configurations obsolete. There are, if you go through the materials that I've submitted and would ask the committee to review, number of individuals in this state, and by number I mean hundreds if not thousands, who've had dock configurations in place since before even 1978, when there were no regulations, and have relied on those and have continued to use them. And our recommendation is that there be some grandfathering, but if not, then there needs to be some compensation. I recognize that some of these suggestions might seem a little radical. From a lakeshore property owner's point of view, they are no more radical than the suggestion that the state has the right to involuntarily deprive the property owner of the use and enjoyment of their lakeshore after years or decades of quiet enjoyment, good aquatic stewardship, and no discernible negative impact. Before I close, if I might, I'd like to address some of the issues that my predecessors raised. We seem to be going back and forth on what percentage of docks are in compliance, and Senator Olson, I know, has heard the 10% figure. I had a two-hour meeting with Tom Hovey over at DNR, who was the DNR's point man on this dock advisory committee in town meetings, and he and I discussed it, and I think the consensus that we raised was that if you're measuring the 10% as a measure of folks that have platforms at all, then it's only 10% who aren't, of people that have docks generally, then 10% is the figure that aren't in compliance. If you're talking about only folks that have dock platforms, our information is that with respect to Gull, the Whitefish Chain, and Minnetonka, you're approaching something like 50% to two-thirds of the people that have platforms that aren't in compliance. But accepting the 10% for a second, it seems to me that that would argue towards allowing grandfathering, since there is not a huge impact by limiting what's happened to what's there, because 90% of the lake owners wouldn't be affected by it anyway. In my discussions with Tom Hovey, he acknowledged that the problem isn't what we have now. It's looking forward, as Senator Olson alluded to, over the next 50 years and deciding where we're going to be. And reasonable regulations are certainly appropriate, and contrary to some public perception, at least the members of Popular recognize that they're living on public waters. But at the same time, if the problem doesn't exist now with respect to aquatic impact, with respect to the environment and issues like that, then why not allow the status quo to be maintained, particularly in light of vague regulations and a lack of enforcement, and focus more on what we're going to allow in the future. I had sent Senator Olson some correspondence some time ago in which I pointed out, and I'll repeat for the committee, that consumers get to vote with their pocketbooks. If they're looking for a pristine, natural environment, they can acquire property on a lake that has been so lack of developed. If, on the other hand, they're looking for a recreational experience, then they're going to tend towards Gull or Whitefish or even Lake Minnetonka. And I think that we ought to be allowing and folks to make that choice. And again, as I think there's general agreement, not having a one-size-fits-all approach. The
Mr. Stern, should there be a size at all?
I think so, Mr. Chair, in terms of the dock platform itself. I think there's
legitimate... There should be a size rule.
as opposed to not allowing anything wider than 8 feet or 4 feet?
Just a general question. Should there be a rule?
Yes. Okay. There should be a rule. Our recommendation is that the rule should allow for exclusive of the last dock extension no more than 200 square feet. And again, the different lake configurations, I'm getting to be more of an expert on this than I thought I could be, make a difference. Apparently, Gull Lake, with wind patterns and everything else, make it more difficult to dock and tie up a boat if there's not a larger mass. I believe that Lake Bemidji, as it's been explained to me, is sort of a flat lake with not a lot of high rise off of the lake, and there's less of a need for a configuration that gives access.
So just to clarify a couple items, Mr. Stern, Senator Olson's bill would include dock regulations as part of the shoreland rulemaking that the legislature mandated and funded last year. That rulemaking has only just been initialized this past January, so it's in the very, very early stages, and it was funded for, Senator Anderson, do you recall, was it funded for 3 years? It was $1 million.
2 years. Okay. 2 years?
For 2 years.
$500,000 each year?
It was funded for 2 years, so there will be a long, it's expected to be a long process, and the rulemaking mandates many meetings, public comment, and the details on these, on whatever standards you feel there should be, are appropriate for that process. But Senator Olson's bill does not prescribe any particular rule. Having said that, I think your views are educational and are helpful, you know, to understand your group's point of view. But I just wanted to make sure you understood that all Senator Olson's bill does is make sure that docks are included in shoreland rulemaking that's just been started. And then the other item that you were talking about with regards to aquatic management rules, that rulemaking is currently going on but that is a separate rulemaking process that's going on with aquatic vegetation, and we had extensive discussions last session in this committee as well on those. Those are a little farther along, I don't know. I don't think it's too late to be involved with that, at least for public comment. I don't quote me on that, but it's but on the aquatic vegetation issue, you should definitely get in touch with DNR Waters and find out where they are on the rulemaking process and make your views known on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Questions for the witness? Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, have you enjoyed the lamb?
You know, Senator Olson, I was debating whether or not to mention that.
It just dawned on me that you outbid me on that.
Yes, ma'am. With my back to Senator Olson, we were engaged in aggressive bidding at Independence's Heritage Days, and I outbid her on the lamb, and I was sort of wondering if she'd remember, and I ask your forgiveness.
Okay, Senator Olson. Then we need to get to the Senator Olson. I don't know. I don't want you to rebut everything Mr. Stern said.
Okay.
If there's nothing else, so why don't we have DNR approach? Thank you, Mr. Stern.
Thank you. Will my written submission be part of the record, then, Your Honor?
We
Mr.
have
Chair?
It here. Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Lacismo, welcome.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, thank you. For the record, I'm Kent Lacismo, Director of Division of Waters for DNR. I'm the one that signed that general permit. As you've heard, this is a passionate issue. And I think if you listen carefully to this testimony so far, you've had recommendations for the platform at the end of the dock from 0 to 250 square feet. And what we issued is kind of right in the middle of that. We don't you know, support the initial legislation as drafted, we thought was problematic. We think the legislation that's as amended has some problems tying it directly to the shoreland rules. Actually, I think that might delay us getting any dock rules out. It is an issue that the section of the rules that was mentioned in here dealing with structures actually ends up dealing with a number of other things. That's docks, boat ramps, waterway obstructions, breakwaters, mooring facilities, retaining walls. So it is a more comprehensive look than just at docks. So there, it would be a fair amount of effort to undertake a rule change. You know, one of the easiest...
Mr. What reference change would make it less onerous?
If on line 1.7 you deleted the everything after 6115 and just directed us to do rules on structures. Because tying it to the shoreland rules are done under section 6120 of rules, so we're basically would end up combining two different rule processes into one hearing, and it's somewhat different clientele. There was discussion of docks when we had the discussion of the alternative shoreland standards in the North Central County Lakes project.
I was trying to figure this out.
In that discussion, it was decided not to address docks because there was no consensus, and it would have drug that process down. So we intentionally decided to decouple those because the shoreland rules deal with activities from the ordinary high water level of a lake and landward, and these rules deal with activities from the ordinary high water level lakeward.
Excuse me? How so? My dock is, the beginning of my dock is completely on land.
Mr. Chairman, what 6115 rules apply to are works below the ordinary high water level of public waters. So that's from the ordinary high water level and waterward.
And the rest of my dock goes below the ordinary high
correct.
Water
mark. There may be some of it that's on land, and that's...
Some of it's on land, some of it's on water. It seems like it applies very easily to 6115.
To 6115, Mr. Chairman, yes. To 6120, not so clear.
Okay. Mr. Knopf, help me out here.
Well, Mr. Chairman, when you talk about 6120, the rules that were required in last year's laws, 2007, Chapter 57, those are rules to Minnesota Rules, Chapter 6120. Those are the shoreland zoning rules that are the state puts out a model ordinance, and then the local units of government adopt that for the ordinary. This is for structures that are above the ordinary high water level. As Mr. Lacusmo is stating, this provision is dealing with Chapter 6115, and those rules deal with the ordinary high water mark and below. And docks are included in that and not in the shoreland portion. As you stated, your dock begins in the shoreland, but if it ended there, then it would be part of the shoreland. But since it does go in below the ordinary high water mark, it's part of the public water rules, which are in Chapter 6115. But his reference to 6120 is a reference to last year's rulemaking requirement
okay.
for the shoreland
oh, okay.
zone.
Okay. So what should this say?
Is that the vegetation or vegetation?
But, Mr. Chairman, it's not what it should say. It's what the committee wishes it to say. Senator Olson has tried to pair it along with it because of the cost of doing rulemaking, that this could be done along with the shoreland zoning rules because there was $1 billion appropriated last year for that. This would be if the decision of the committee is to not have this go along with the same rulemaking process, then you need to strike that reference to the rulemaking required. And then there would be the issue of how these rules are going to be accomplished and paid for.
So the way it's written now would not require
a new appropriation.
The way it's written now piggybacks on the shoreland standards.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Okay. All right. Senator Olson.
And Mr. Chair, with due respect to Mr. Lacusmo, the Lake Associations, the local governments, the biologists, and the people who have the technical information related to these issues. They really go hand in hand. They may be separated in our statutes under different and addressed under different rules, but as a practical matter, the issues are very integrated and related. And to spend separate money and to wait 5 years to look at the structures component of this and go through a whole other round of rulemaking really doesn't make sense. We had a when I was in Hackensack, there were people who had been involved with the North Central County Lakes
project
that was part of the initial rulemaking, and they stated publicly and on the record that they were that their recommendation was to look at this as part of that, but that there was intervention from outside the process because of some calls that were made. And again, I don't know this to be true firsthand, so I just want to qualify that this is what a gentleman involved in the process said at the public meeting, and that there came that some calls came from the top to basically disengage this, the dock issue or the looking at these things from this process. And I have also been told by the DNR rank and file people concerned about this that they support what I'm doing and that there's a feeling that that this has become more of a political issue than it has something that makes sense from a scientific standpoint.
Well, whatever their reason was for decoupling the issue, it's our choice whether to recouple it or not.
Understand, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Mr. Locks.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, you know, what we're struggling with here is a balance between the riparian rights of lakeshore owners and what reasonable use is. And we have had, the last set of permit rules was in 1989, We had permit rules in 1989 that had separate standards for seasonal docks and for permanent docks. Permanent docks had a width associated with it of 6 feet. And primarily those were rock crib docks in northern Minnesota on rock shoreline, so they couldn't put in your typical 4-foot-wide dock. In 2002, we combined the seasonal and the permanent docks into one standard, and it was with an 8-foot dock width. So if you looked on the back of the brochure that was handed out, on the right shows some configurations that have an 8-foot width, and the one on the far right I'd point your attention to is compliant with the existing rules. The one in the middle that's crosshatch shaded for the dock platform, the reason that ends up being not compliant is dock sections now are built typically in 4x10 or 5x10 sections. And because that's 10 feet long instead of 8 feet long, it became non-compliant. So what we're talking about on that center diagram is an excess area of 24 square feet that makes it not compliant under the existing rule. That's something that ends up being relatively common. If you went to the boat show this year and picked up brochures, which I did from all the dock manufacturers, all of them are showing platforms, additional sections of dock. They were all compliant with what we issued as a general permit, I think, except for one manufacturer showed some things larger. These are individual sections that you can configure in many different ways, but if you have this nominal dimension of 10 feet, you end up being a little bit over what the old rule or the existing rule provides. And what we've said under the general permit, we have restricted it from the first permit that we issued. The first permit was for all lakes, and the general permit that was issued this year is limited to only recreational development and general development lakes. That's about 1,000 lakes out of the state. The other 8,247, I think it was, lakes are natural environment lakes. This general permit does not apply to those. So this is on the more of the major recreational lakes. The
are there docks on natural environment lakes?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Are they regulated?
For the dock platforms or decks, whichever we wish to call them, that are not compliant with what we issued as a general permit, there's two choices for landowners. They can apply for a permit, and we would evaluate it, just like they should have applied from 1989 on, or even prior to 1989. We had permit jurisdiction, but that was the first permit rules. And
or they can bring their dock into compliance. And I've talked to some people that have called me, and they can reconfigure how they put their dock together and bring it into compliance. Others will have to apply for a permit. And we've gotten several applications, I know, already, and we'll be processing those. Well, one other point I'd like to make, based on the previous testimony about the swim raft. Swim rafts or hazards to navigation are handled by the county sheriff. So if, in fact, that's a hazard to navigation, and I think that Mr. Johnson left, but he should direct his concern to the county sheriff, and they can take care of that. So there is a process to deal with that. You know, the easiest thing here is for somebody to pick a number or for the legislature to pass something that's a number and we'll enforce it. We certainly can go through a rule process and develop a number. I don't believe that it's very effective to combine it with the shoreline standards.
So the people didn't apply for application, didn't apply for a permit.
I didn't hear you, Mr. Chairman.
The people didn't apply for a permit. The manufacturer's already making them bigger. It's the sheriff's job. What role does the DNR play in all this?
Well, Mr. Chairman, it's the sheriff's job to deal with hazards to navigation. And they deal with that in conjunction with conservation officers, but the primary responsibility is with the county sheriff. So if you had everybody along the one shore of a lake had 50-foot long docks, and the next person puts out a 100-foot dock, that would be a problem, and that would be dealt with.
Whose responsibility is it to enforce permits or lack thereof on docks?
For permits under our jurisdiction for docks, it would be DNR's.
Why haven't they been enforced in the past?
The for permanent docks, we have regulated those. Seasonal docks have essentially never been regulated. And how many seasonal docks there are in the state, I don't really know. 2 years ago, when we became more aware of these larger platforms starting, we started some enforcement. And then there were issues with that based on these, like I explained, for the dimensions now being 4x10 and an extra 24 square feet versus the total size of the dock, we elected to issue a general permit. These are the kinds of activities that we would routinely issue permits for and have minimal impact.
Why did the DNR start enforcing the rules just 2 years ago?
Mr. Chairman, we have enforced dock sizes where in some locations. 2 years ago is when it became more apparent. There were some flyovers. We saw several large platforms, and the enforcement officers on a couple of lakes started enforcing.
So if you started enforcing 2 years ago after realizing there was a problem, why did the DNR issue a permit to legalize them?
Mr. Chairman, as I explained, there were some of those examples. And some of the individuals that got cease and desist orders had 12 square feet extra dock area than they could have under the existing permit rule. And we felt that it wasn't a high enough priority for our limited staff time to pursue a 12 square foot extra dock size.
Why hasn't the DNR proposed repeal of the rule then?
Well, Mr. Chairman, we can go through the rule. Is fine if you're okay with 8 foot wide docks and 8 foot wide L's or T's. We need to have a rule that addresses dock sizes, and we can go through a rule amendment and develop new standards. And I expect the debate will be long and difficult whether it should be zero or 250 square feet.
Why have a rule if it's not a high enough priority to enforce it?
Mr. Chairman, the permit rules cover all types of activities in public waters, and that's what we've based our, it's what we administer on all public waters of the state. But there are seasonal docks and boat lifts and accessory structures are something that have never been permitted, and we're looking now at how do we get a handle on what's happened in the dock industry to build larger structures.
So what is the DNR looking at doing?
Through the process that we had last year, we held the meetings, we had an advisory committee having some discussions, and we issued a general permit for 5 years. And if you look at the general permit, it's for 5 years or until new rules become effective. And the reason it's for 5 years is that's the maximum length of time that we can issue permits for under the law. We intend, and there was a lot of discussion at this meeting, to hurry up and do rules and to only issue a permit for a year. We can't get rules done that fast. If we started today, there's no way we could make it by March 15th of 09. And that's not in the bill anymore. It's an 18-month process, assuming there's no controversy. And I think with the testimony you heard today, there will be controversy.
What is the DNR's proposal to address this issue?
Mr. Chairman, what we're doing is, one, we want to get a better handle on the number. I think you've heard from Mr. Stern there's hundreds of thousands, or there's been big numbers out there. We don't think it's nearly that that many. There are some of these. They may be located only on those major recreational lakes of the Whitefish, Chain, Gull, and Minnetonka. I know there's some on other lakes. Some of the other enforcement was on Big Deep Lake. So there are some. But what we need to do is get a handle on really how big of a problem this is. And that's what we're doing now. And we're evaluating the types of applications that we get. We've only received a couple so far to authorize these platforms that are larger than the general permit. And we will be looking at doing new rules. We made that, there was that discussion during the process. It's just that we don't have the capability at the present time to jump into a brand new rule process. And, if this is tied to the shoreland rules, that will delay that. The shoreland rules are, like I believe you said, Mr. Chairman, just getting going, and we have lots of advisory committees. It'll be a whole different group of advisory committees, and it'll be a much more complicated process and potentially take longer.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for the benefit of the members here, could you go through the process of enforcing a violation or alleged violation of a permit?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebrigtsen. There's a number of different ways that that could be enforced. The most typical way of recently has been for a conservation officer to issue a cease and desist order, and they would require the individual to bring it into compliance or obtain a permit. And or the other alternative would be to issue a ticket. That takes approval from the or essentially concurrence from the county attorney that he would wish to process that as a misdemeanor of having work done in public waters without first obtaining the permit. And the third option would be for us to issue a restoration for removal. These are a little different issues because it's a seasonal structure that goes in and out annually.
We need to close this up because Senator Stump has a witness from who has come a long way. Does this bill need to go to state and local government?
Yes.
Okay. Why don't we entertain a motion and then we'll take final comments. Senator Fredrickson.
I don't have a motion, but Mr. Lacazmo, how much additional money would it take to separate out the rulemaking for DOT if we were to choose to go that way?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Fredrickson, I think whether you separate it out or not, it will take additional resources and additional money, and our estimate was probably $100,000. just in doing the advisory committee that we ended up with was probably a quarter FTE over the last year to accomplish that. This would be much more extensive.
We gave them $1 million last year to do this. They don't need any more money to add on the dock issue to their shoreline standards.
But Mr. Chairman, that may be so, but it sounds like it will delay the rulemaking that they've already started that we thought was very vital if they have to add the dock to it.
I doubt that very highly. It's just begun. This is at least an 18-month process. This is an issue that needs to be resolved. It's relevant, and I don't understand why the department would testify to that anyway. It sounds like, given their testimony, they're really stuck on this issue. They didn't enforce the rule for many years, and when they decided to, they realized that the industry standards had gone beyond their current rules. And I think this gives Senator Olson gives the department and this issue the proper guidance on how to resolve it. This should be welcomed.
But Mr. Chairman, our rulemaking process is pretty well determined and pretty well set, explicitly set in statute. And mm-hmm. I'm not sure that they can just add another issue to a rulemaking process that's already been started.
Well, let's let the State and Local Government Committee figure that out.
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Lacismo said it would cost $100,000 extra. Did you mean either way? I think the question that was put to you was either way, whether it's combined or separate. Are you saying that's the additional amount of money either way?
Mr. Chairman, Lacismo. Senator Anderson, yes, either way.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, then I think we just need to have that discussion about which – I mean, I hear what Senator Olson is saying. There may be some efficiencies to be gained by combining it, but I don't know if there's barriers that it would also – that would stand in the way of it. So we have to – you know, we can talk about what's the best way to do it, but I think the process should move forward.
Yeah. I mean, this issue is not going to receive death by fiscal note. Well, Senator Olson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, maybe I'm just a bit naive, but why does one set of rules require $1 million and the other one only $100,000?
Question. Yeah. Just a little difference there.
Well, I mean, I have that question too, but just to take their side, the shoreline standards are. They're probably voluminous. They've probably got a lot of issues they got to work through, and it's going to take time and a lot of public comment and a lot of public meetings. So we deferred to the department on what they thought it was going to cost.
But Mr. Chairman,
to add this issue in the discussion.
But Mr. Chairman, you think that $900,000 would be adequate for that one, and $100,000 would be okay for this?
I don't think any money is needed to add this to the shoreline rules. I think $1 million to is plenty to accommodate it all.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that we should pass this bill on to state and local government and let them have a little more discussion about the rulemaking process.
Sure.
And then if the department wants to write a fiscal note, we'll look at it. And I mean, I think we're not quite there yet in terms of figuring out the right way to proceed on this. I think we need a little more discussion about those two issues. Yeah. But I think the concept definitely needs to move forward. So I would move that Senate file 3237 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on State and Local Government.
All right. Further discussion? Senator Olson, you have the last word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to comment that since the DNR acknowledges the need to address this issue and the fact that they've stated that this is a relatively small problem now, but what they've authorized is for this to become a much bigger problem over the next 5 years as we have a change in the law that will allow these platforms that are quite a bit bigger than I think than the size of this table that you're sitting on the end of every dock. The more of those we have, the bigger, the more expensive it's going to be to get a handle on this problem to address it at a later point in time.
Well, and Mr. Chair, I would remind committee members if, you know, the rulemaking process doesn't preordain the outcome either. So if we move this bill forward, we're just saying there needs to be a vigorous public process, a transparent and open process that decides what the balance is and where that should end up. I don't know that this committee even has to decide that today. I hear what you're saying, Senator Olson. I'm really sympathetic. But I think for members who might not feel that way, it's not – this vote doesn't preordain that.
Right.
Otherwise, this committee can also debate what size the dock should be on each lake.
That's an alternative.
We can set that in statute.
Mr. Chair.
I think it's better off with a public process conducted by the department. Mr. Meyer?
Mr. Chair, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. Just on that note, there is some science behind how big a dock should be, but a large part of it is a social decision. And if it is a committee's decision to get this out there and to reduce the size of docks or stop a problem that people may perceive of happening, I would encourage you to think about just putting the size of a dock structure in statute rather than having us go through the rulemaking process and come back with perhaps a size of 120 feet that people still don't like, and then we're no farther along than we are today. So that's just another option, Mr. Chair.
Exactly. On the motion, seeing no more discussion, all those in favor? Senator Dibble?
Mr. Chair, I want to debate the size of docks.
Mr. Chair, I was just proposing, let's create a dock subcommittee.
There will be a meeting at noon.
Chairman, could that be July 15th?
In your office. On your
there'll be a meeting at my cabin this summer to debate that. All right. On the motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you very much,
you,
Mr. Chair, committee members.
Senator Stump, why don't we quickly take your witness's testimony, and then we'll have to revisit the bill tonight.
Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Stephen Anderson, is that you? Okay, great. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, just to give committee just a little bit of a preview, last year in the settlement of our session, one of the exemptions for a development that had an exemption prior to prior to that repeal was War Road Estates. And if you could envision War Road, the city of War Road is tucked right alongside of the Lake of the Woods, and right north of the city is a rather large development that has been going on for a number of years. And that development includes a golf course, an 18-hole golf course, and includes, I believe, about 270 lots that are being developed. Mr. Anderson is part of that development, although most of those lots, I believe, are now privately owned. It's a very important part of the community because as the city grew, those lots were being developed. And right between Spring Steel Island, which is a highly developed island and well-known for its fishing and summer recreation, and one of the problems that we're having up there is with the repeal, that exemption, those 100 lots that are privately owned will not be developed. And as that land is not developed, then it reduces the potential, the possibility for us to put in the wastewater treatment system, which is needed in that area because it's very close to Lake of the Woods, which is international waters. And Spring Steel Island will be hooked up to that system as well. So what we're asking, and we have an amendment, Mr. Chairman, which I think would be good to hand out. We've been working with Bowser on that, and I believe we have a worked-out agreement that would be acceptable, and it would be good for the members of the committee to look at that. And so Mr. Anderson is from War Road, lives in the War Road Estates, and can give you more background and information on a rather long history of it.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Anderson. If you wouldn't mind summing up your history, we'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Chairman. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today.
And we appreciate you coming down all this way.
It's my pleasure, and I'll try to be as brief as possible. It is a fairly short, straightforward issue that we're dealing with. Last year, with the repealing of the approved development extension of the Wetland Conservation Act, that had a detrimental impact on Warroad Estates. And that's where I live. Warroad Estates, it's a residential development between the city of Warroad and Springsteel Island, right on Lake Woods. A little bit of a history. It was initially started, the development, in 1974 with the recording of plats for these lots. At the time that this development was established and the plats were recorded, that was with the knowledge, the approval, and the involvement of Lake Township with Roseau County and even the Corps of Engineers, because associated with this development is a 250-slip marina that's attached to Lake of the Woods. So all of this has been going on for a number of years, 30-plus years. There's an 18-hole golf course on there, like I indicated, at this 250-slip marina. There's about 270 lots total that are platted out there, and there's 100 that have not yet been developed. And we're talking about the effect on these roughly 100. Not every one of those 100 lots will be affected, but a significant percentage, 50% or more of those lots, are affected by this exemption.
They're affected in that they would have to do replacement.
Well, yes, and what the problem is that the land costs up there are fairly minimal. It's not that significant, and if you start talking about replacement costs and buying credits and whatnot, it literally makes the cost of that land 2 to 3 times higher than what it normally would be. So what we have is we've got the infrastructure in place there. There's paved roads that assessments are still being paid on. Comprehensive drainage to the lots. There's electrical service to the lots. There's water service. There's telephone service to the lots. Cable TV. The buses go out there. There's 150, 170 residential homes out there. It's been a continual but a gradual development of the area, and I think that's where the problem has been. It's a somewhat of a unique situation that, because of its remote location, it hasn't, once these lots development was started, it wasn't immediate, quick development. It's been going on for a period of years. So what our concern is that you have all this infrastructure in place, but if, and the development was fine as long as there was this approved development exemption to the wetlands law. With the appeal of that, there hasn't been a single house built since then, and I think it's going to be economically not feasible to develop those lots. What the practical impact's going to be is that people will just simply say, if I can't develop this lot in an economical way, we'll let it go back for taxes and special assessments. And I think that's going to have a little bit of a problem on putting any kind of a septic system in here. As indicated, just north of there, Springsteel Island, over the last year, year and a half, 2 years, a sanitary district was established. There is a sewer system going in there. But if you can't distribute the cost of that at Warroad Estates over all of those lots versus just what's in there now, it's going to be feasible to do.
Why has it taken over 30 years to develop?
As Senator Stump indicated, it's a unique situation because I think initially the idea was that this would be a recreational area. It would develop much more quickly. But that's not what has taken place. What's actually happened is it's gradually grown as the city of Warroad has grown. And I would estimate that maybe 9 out of the 10 homes out there currently are full-time residents rather than any kind of a recreational area.
So it's just slow economic growth. You don't
right.
get the sales.
Exactly.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I apologize if you already mentioned this in your opening comments, but I missed it. How many potential units in the development?
A total of about 270, and with approximately 170 of those developed.
170. 100. And Mr. Chair, how much wetland would have to be replaced without this bill?
Mr. Anderson.
Right. There was when there was the exemption in place, there was no requirement for any mitigation.
Right, I understand that.
So,
but under current law.
Individual lots, then, on a certain lot, it may be that the lots are roughly a half an acre each, 100 by 200. Some of those lots, they would be entirely within a wetland, and the entire thing would have, lot would happen.
Mr. Chairman, when we passed the wetlands laws way back in the early 90s, the reason for the exemption was to grant those platted areas, grandfather those platted areas in for development. And I think all of us were surprised when we realized that that exemption was taken away, because for War Road Estates, that exemption was still being used. For many other developments that had that exemption, I'm sure that development had already been completed. And so it was, the way the amendment that we're proposing would be to allow those areas that have 80% of their existing wetlands and to give War Road Estates a period of time, several years, to go ahead and finish that development.
Do you think you'll be done by 2013, Mr. Anderson?
I don't think that it'll be 100% completed, but at the same time, I think that's a reasonable period of time to give people notice to do something.
We've got to clean up this table, but I want to thank you for the testimony. The question, I think the central question I have, and this is probably for Mr. Wirens, how many developments similar to this exist in the over 80% area? And between now and 6 o'clock, if you can give us an idea, that would be great. Senator Stumpf will move the A2. That's an author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Thank you, Mr. Anderson. We will be in recess until 6 p.m.
Mr. Chair, another committee's coming in. Is that what you said?
Economic
yes.
Development.
Members should probably try to put things they want to keep.
Yeah, and staff will
have
save
to help
it
with
for
that
you
too.
As well.
Yeah.
Sit in the same chair.
Committee's in recess.
Yeah.